WOR Radio, your station for news. Next.
Hey, did you hear that son of a gun promoting WGN here on this decent radio station? This is the family station. What's happening to WOR? Don't they know about WGN? Oh, Saturday nights at 2 o'clock in the morning in the engineering department of WGN, let me tell you. I could tell you stories about that outfit that would curl the back hair on your ears. You know, speaking of WGN, it's funny, probably 94% of the people here never heard of WGN, but WGN plays an unbelievable, or did at least when I was a kid, almost a psychotically important role in the lives of everybody out there at that time. I will award the Brass Figligee with bronze oak leaf palm to any listener who will rise above the mire and the muck of ordinary listenerdom to tell me what WGN stands for. No, don't. Just, it's a pure, what does it stand for? The letter stands for something. It does not stand for good night. There were a lot of things that guys, when they were fired from jobs there, said it stood for. There were all kinds of fantastic definitions of what it stood for, some of which, you know, it's amazing how creative the human mind can be under duress. I knew a guy that couldn't think of his own name half the time. And once he got bounced out of all the way down the street, doggerel, verse, limerick, epic poetry, the whole bit's coming out. You know, I didn't mean to do this, and I won't do it tonight, but I'll tell you, I had an experience once with WGN that I will never forget. I was working on a miserable little nothing rotten radio station, the terrible little radio station, and Bob, come here, listen to this story. It's a funny thing. You guys are on the other, you'd stand there for me. You guys are on the other side of the glass. I want to tell you something about the guy on this side of the glass once. The dreams that goes through his mind, just as you guys who are operating the control board, who operate all the equipment here, you must occasionally have visions of yourself running some gigantic, enormous control board that controls the whole universe. You know, that you can plug in Mars with Venus and you're in charge of, you know, of course. You think you got it here, forget it. Well, let me tell you what happened with me one night. I'm working in this 2-bit radio station. I'll tell you, 2-bit, let me tell you, this was about a 14-cent radio station. It was the kind of radio station where I remember the guy called me one day, the program director, and he says, we're going to pay a talent fee on this. And I said, a talent fee on this show that I was going to do? He's going to do a special show. Come in Saturday morning. I was off on the weekend. They let me come in Saturday morning. I says, a special talent fee. What do you get? Talent fee. He says, $1.50. And that was considered a gigantic talent fee. Well, this radio station, I used to, at the end of the week, I used to be able to sit down. I worked about 45 hours a day there. And at the end of the week, I could look forward to counting over, in good hard cash of the realm, $19.85. $19.85. And we had a signal. Believe it or not, it's the only radio station I knew of at that time that had an indoor antenna. They did. They had an indoor antenna, and you know what they had? But you don't believe it? Let me tell you what they had. They had an old Western Electric transmitter that was using the framework of the building. Yes, it was a loaded counterpoise. Now, if you want to get into the counterpoise theory here, it's a great antenna theory. So we didn't even have an aerial, you know. We just used the building there, and we had a hearing radius. You could hear this station clearly for over 7 blocks. You could hear it very clearly for over 7 blocks. Sometimes on a really good night when the ground was wet, you could hear it for a mile and a half. A very good night. Well, of course, I was profoundly depressed. You cannot understand how terrible it is to work in a situation where it, everything looks almost like what it should be, but it never quite makes it. It's like being the best left-handed pitcher in the Class D League somewhere way out in the Arkansas Pony, you know, and 20-something, you know, and your suit looks just like the Yankee suit, you know. That's the thing that bothers you. You got the same kind of glove that Roger Maris carries out to the Yankee Stadium every night, but you're still playing for Slippery Rock. Well, you after a while, when you're out there, I'm sure that many a center fielder playing for Moline, standing out there in the pitch darkness with 3 light bulbs hanging over his head, you know, and the mosquitoes and the flies. He hears that shot, you know, Somebody hits a ball, and he sees himself, his mind, he sees himself drifting back. For one instant, you see, he's Willie Mays. He's with the Giants. He's drifting back. But there it is, hanging right across the front. It says Moline Seals. He can't get out of it. Well, I'm playing ball for this crummy, rotten little radio station that was really something. One night, this is the thing that occurred to me. It was like a Freudian slip. One night, when all of the dreams, everything came right out in the open. I was sitting in there, and I was on the board and everything, you know, and I was waiting for the cue to come up. We were carrying a lousy little network show, and I was waiting for the cue to come up for me to give the station break. Well, this station, let's say it's had its call, it is a slogan like, KLUNCK, something like that, or, THUD, some nothing station. See, so I'm sitting in there and I'm waiting to get the station break, and all of a sudden it comes up and it's 4:29:30, boop, it goes. I said, this is WGN Chicago. And the engineer looked at me. Time was ticking by. The next network show says, WGN Chicago. Boop. On came the next network show. The point I'm making here is that wild dreams there for a moment, and I was in another world. I was working in another league. I was generating other sparks. But I could be heard clearly for a block and a half on that day. The wind was bad that afternoon. You know, speaking of wind, as long as we're here, this is a Saturday night. This is the first night of summer, boy. And this is going to be a long, hot one, and there's going to be a lot of swinging this summer. I see it in the cards. I can see it out there, the way the Big Dipper is shaped. I can see it. You know, the old-timers can tell when they look at a caterpillar. What kind of a summer it's going to be. Well, I have other signs. Now they always talk about whether your knee hurts, you know. If your knee hurts, it's going to be a long winter. Well, I have my signs, and I can tell you this is going to be a swinging summer. There's going to be a lot of swinging. A lot of stuff is going to happen to a lot of guys that they're going to regret the rest of their lives. There's going to be a lot of stuff happen. There's going to be a lot of people 50 years from now look back on the summer of 1963. Why did I, what, for crying out loud, I'll never forget. I was listening to that nut on the radio and he warned me. He warned me and I'm sitting there laughing away. Next thing you know, the die was cast all of my life and now I'm sitting here with you. Oh, you. Oh. And then the chick looks him right in the eye and says, you should talk. You're sitting here with me. Remember, I'm sitting with you. Oh, boy, 50 years, time and tide goes by and the glacier melts. Well, it's going to be that way, you know. It's warming up. It's warming up. I can see already. It's already, guys are throwing pineapples out in the middle of the infield at polo grounds. The next thing you know, somebody's going to lob a bazooka shell out there. You'll wait and see. Oh, yeah. I expect some guy to bring a flamethrower out there to around the third base coaching department. They're right back at third base, hidden under his I Love the Mets jersey, you know, that kind of thing. He'll be carrying, you know, his rolled-up copy of the Post and all the rest of it, you know, and it's going to happen. It's just one of those, it's a summer like that, you see, because this is the time of the yeast. Do you realize that the Orientals particularly recognize that this time, there is an Oriental term which refers to the time of the germination, the yeast, the time of the bubbling. Now, most of you have been fortunate never to live close enough to a swamp to know exactly what that means. But at this time of the year, just about this time, a couple of more weeks, when I'm sacked out in the pad, you know, I'm a kid and about, oh, half a block away, the swamp was. We had the swamp. And about a half a block away, you could hear it once in a while. It would start about midnight. And, of course, it was hot. And the gases would start to rise. And you could smell it. And you'd hear, bloop, bloop. And I'm laying there sacked out, you see. It's life germinating. Bloop, bloop, bloop. I'd hear another big bubble rise to the surface. And let me tell you, when you're about 9 years old, you begin to feel the yeast flowing through your veins, your very veins themselves. The swamp water and me, we were all part of the same thing. Would go. Oh, my God. I'll tell you, my eyeballs would start to sweat, and I'm laying there. I'd hear that, and then the frogs would start yelling and hollering. And it was summertime, you see. And then there would be visions of Esther Jane Albury would dance before my eyes. Esther Jane Albury. Yeah, that's terrible now. Think about it now. It's ridiculous with the awful skin condition she had yet. But nevertheless, that did not stop me. We were very uncritical in those days. Anything that moved was faintly female, you know, was very interesting. But here, out there, and the old swamp. I say that one thing they should sell to all city kids. I think that, you know, they have these educational toys. You know, they have you can get a little Ben Casey kit, little scalpels and forceps, and you get a little junior psychiatrist kit and all that stuff now. Well, I say that over at FAO Schwartz, they should sell for rich kids a small swamp. A small swamp that could be put in the backyard. A real swamp with snakes and with a mud hen in it. And all kinds of greasy little rotten things that crawl around on the bottom. And once in a while, and a gas, a strange, mysterious smell of methane would float out through those Westchester backyards. And the kid would begin to understand something about this wild, insane world, this germination of the world, you know, life itself. I'm talking about the substance of life. I'm not talking necessarily about people or groups. I'm just talking about all of life. And it was on nights like this, I can remember my old man would come home, see, he'd drive the Graham Page, and he'd come whipping up the driveway, up the driveway in a cloud of dust, slam the door, and come rushing up the back porch into the kitchen, and he'd come in, you know, the funny look in the eye with a straw skimmer, there'd be a short pause, and he says, boy, this, it's on nights like this that I want to go out and hunt for the elephant's graveyard. On nights like this, I want to go out and hunt for the elephant's graveyard. And of course, you know, I'm just a squirt there. I'm sitting around, and I'd hear this, the elephant's graveyard. And it was a story that had oft been told. You know, just like every family has stories that are oft told. Well, this was the oft-told story, and it was a perfect cue for either me or my kid brother to say, What's the elephant's graveyard, Dad? He'd say, well, the elephant's graveyard. I'm glad you brought that up. The elephant's graveyard, son, is where it's a mysterious place. It's a place somewhere in Africa where all the great elephants, when they are about to die, go to die, and it is a secret place. And nobody has ever found where it is. And the elephant's graveyard is someplace in the jungle, and all the elephants have died throughout all the countless ages in the past. And the whole ground is carpeted with magnificent ivory. And you discover the elephant's graveyard, and it is, you're just infinitely rich. That thousands of men, and I would sit there, yeah, he'd say, yes, you know, thousands of men have died in the wilds of darkest Africa searching for the elephant's graveyard. And someday I'm going to go and hunt for the elephant's graveyard. And there'd be that warm summer atmosphere out there in the swamp. Would go, and I'd hear the frogs yelling and the mud hens a bellowing out there. And I'd hear Esther Jane Albury going past on her bike. She goes past. Oh, boy. And at, speaking of swamps, by the way, this is WOR AM and FM New York. And we might as well get rid of this jazz. I could tell you, do you want to hear the story of the elephant's graveyard? Do you want to hear any more about that story? This is something you don't hear any more about, but let me tell you, it's there. It lies right below. It is there. You cannot, right, Ed? Yes, sirree. I mean, I don't care. Let me tell you, I don't care what you, I know it's there. It is there. And no, there's a reason for it. No, there's a reason for it, because elephants are very embarrassed. They don't, no, they are. They're very shy animals, and they're very embarrassed animals. And when an elephant, you know, has supernatural powers, that an elephant knows when he's about to die. Oh, yes. And he has an instinctive compass in him. And that when the elephant is about to die, the little overload relay kicks over, and the compass takes over, and he begins to plunge through the jungle, through those countless, trackless wastes of darkest Africa. He is looking for the one thing that he himself, as an elephant, knows exists, and he knows where it is. And I'll tell you some more things about the elephant graveyard. If you want to hear more about it, there are other things about the elephant's graveyard. Do you know that there has been rumored from time to time? Of course, the elephant's graveyard, they know something about it. One of the things they know about it is that it is near a lost waterfall. It is near a lost waterfall. Yes, that is one of the distinct clues that they know about the elephant's graveyard. There is a lost waterfall there. And furthermore, they know that at this time of the year, this time, spring, summer, the germination time, that's the only time to look for the elephant's graveyard. Because you know why? The elephants get careless at this time of the year. They're swinging and hollering, you know? You know, it's like all the rest of us. Oh, yeah, they're yelling and hollering and swinging, and they get very careless. You see, an elephant, no, that's true, that an elephant under all normal conditions will guard his path. He will guard, let me tell you, where he's been and where he's going. He tells nobody. But at this time of the year, he begins to get foolish. He giggles. Oh, yes, elephants will do all kinds of things. They chew gum and yell and holler. And at this time of the year is the one time that you can tell where the elephant could possibly, if ever, detect where the elephant's graveyard is. And as long as I, for all the years I remember, my old man, he used to say, and don't you dare write me a letter and tell me not to call my father my old man. It's my old man I'm talking about, not yours. And if I called my father ever once father, he would have looked around in back of him to see who I was talking to. He would not have recognized if I said, father, that's an Eastern thing. They don't call fathers father out in the Midwest. That's Eastern. Did you know that? Oh, sure. Well, father, Chucky has a father, you know. Guys in the Midwest have people call their old man, or they have a guy called dad. There's nobody called father out there. I'm just sorry. This is a different country out there. Well, as long as I knew my, he always talked at this time of the year about going after the elephant's graveyard. Now, he found many substitutes for it. One of his substitutes was a used car lot. When my old man would pass a used car lot in the springtime, Eddie, he would break out in a rash. Literally break out into a sweat, a cold sweat. My mother had to pull him past used car lots by physical force. I can remember times when we would be going to visit somebody, you know, like my grandmother on Saturday, and we'd be going past the used car. The old man would get hung up in front of a Graham Page or a Hupmobile, or he'd get hung up in front of a Rockne. He'd stand there, and I can remember her pulling him. Come on, we're late! She's got the roast on! And the old man'd say, wait a minute, this is a, wait, just a minute, here, let me look at that, not just 1 minute, now hold on! And then we'd say, all right. And we'd stand, and he'd walk around this Essex. It was the elephant's graveyard. It was all over again. He had an idea that there was some place where all the perfect used cars went. And he was going to find it. All he ever found, of course, were these cars that on every Saturday had been used for racing by guys named Dillinger. And they had plugged up bullet holes all over them. You know, that kind of stuff. It was the only kind of used car I ever really bought. We bought a Hupmobile one time. Had the only one I've ever saw. They had a balsa wood frame. I don't know where he got this thing. It was insane. It was such a turkey I never saw. The minute we drove out of the used car lot, that car doubled back on itself and went crabwise down the street. It had a busted frame like you never saw in your life. And And my mother was so mad. Well, you don't want to hear the rest of that story, do you, about that one? But he found many, many, many substitutes for the elephant's graveyard. And the substitutes are so many and very... Do you want to hear a great elephant story? Are you an elephant man, really? Listen, I'll tell you. I one time saw... Boy, I'll tell you, it's something you'll never forget. If you ever see... You know, we get very jaded, people do, living in a mechanical world, a world that's almost entirely abstract, and we get all excited if we see a horse in Central Park. We really do. We think that's a tremendous thing. We get all nervous if we see a squirrel running up and down a tree in Westchester someplace, you know, it's all very exciting. Well, I remember several things that occurred to me. One thing that I'll never forget, I will never forget one time seeing in its actual home, real habitat, a genuine African bull elephant. And you just do not forget that. You just do not forget that. There was a beautiful movie made a few years ago. It's right on the tip of my tongue. Roots of Heaven. Romain Gary. Wasn't it Romain Gary who wrote the novel? Roots of Heaven. And I got just a little bit of that out of that movie. And the desire of this man to save that. It was a wonderful allegory. He was not talking about saving elephants. He was talking about saving something else. And I remember seeing this elephant. And this elephant must have been about 6 o'clock. You know, in the area where elephants live, in Africa, there is no such thing as twilight. You're aware of that, of course. It is either daylight, bright, unbelievably hot daylight, or cold, clammy night. It just, chunk, it drops like that. Well, it was just about that at that moment that this guy made his appearance, and I will never forget it. It was one brief moment, and of course that's all connected with the swamp comment, because I think that the kids who live in today's very, very clipped world, what they call the country now is not at all the country. It's like an extension of a golf course. The country out around Westport, Westchester, even Bucks County, is all one long, beautifully trimmed, combed, clipped. Everything is all clipped and controlled, you know. And for that reason, how can I express this thing of nature that the uncontrolled is the most exciting? The thing that is uncontrolled, that is uncontrolled in such a way that it is really what it is. We had a swamp, and if you've ever lived near a swamp, you will know what I mean by a swamp. It is not a lake. A swamp is not a lake. It was not a river. It was not a pond. It was a swamp. Now, one thing about swamps that you know immediately if you've ever lived near one is there's probably nothing more mysterious in nature than a swamp. Even though other things are more spectacular. The thing about a swamp is it's not defined. That's what makes it mysterious. A lake has banks. You know, there's banks to a lake. There are banks to a river. There is the rim of a canyon, even if it's a giant canyon. A swamp has no banks. It has no rim. It doesn't even have a real bottom. It really doesn't. It's very peculiar because you see, a swamp covers over trees. It covers over. It runs over and permeates and infiltrates among plants and roots and roads and all kinds of things, and it becomes sort of an amorphous nature force itself. One of the most exciting places to go in the world, I think, is the Everglades, because the Everglades is that absolutely uncontrollable, mysterious thing. Somehow you can control the Grand Canyon because you can take pictures of it. You just can't take a picture of the Everglades. It's too sneaky. It creeps, it crawls, and it's everywhere at the same time, and yet it's really quite nowhere. You don't know when you're in the swamp. And the swamp has more creatures. There are more things live in swamps than any other single force of nature. Boy, I'll tell you find things. And we used to go out at this time of the year. I can remember this was the time for seining. Seining. This is a word that meaning you net things. Now, you would go out. We would go out. We would take a gunny sack. And believe me, this has nothing to do with nostalgia. It has to do with just the life force. That's all. You'd take a gunny sack and you'd slit it. And you'd make like a long, would be about the length, it was a potato sack, it would be about 6 feet long then, a long strip of burlap that would be very porous. And you would tack it to broom handles, two broom handles, one on each end. And then there were two kids, and one guy in the middle would go plunging into the swamp, literally plunging into the swamp. Now it had mud up to your neck and slumming around, and we're seining. We don't know what we're seining for. We're just seining in the water. Shh. We'd seine like mad. No, we'd pull it up, and stuff would be flopping. Yeah, and stuff would be all kinds of wild stuff. Once in a great while, you see, we would get things like crawdads, big fat crawdads we'd seine out of it. No, a crawdad is like a little, a crawdad, if you don't know what a crawdad is, I don't know what to tell you. A crawdad is actually a small vest pocket miniature lobster. It's a little crustacean, a little lobster is what it really is. It doesn't have a lobster claws, but it's exactly like a little lobster. We seine these things out. Then we'd also get enormous pollywogs, because at about this time they're turning into big frogs. And once in a great while, we would get a salamander. Yes, a salamander is a kind of a lizard-like thing with feet. And he's got orange around the, rough around the head. And we'd seine him, grab him, hey, grab him, flick, hoop, and he goes, wow, for crying out, I want you to grab him, flick. He's gone. He's in the water. And then we'd madly start seining again. Then occasionally the terrible disaster would happen. And this is where you begin to understand the life force. We would seine up a water moccasin. Yeah, oh yeah, we'd be seining. We'd rush up on the bank, we'd look in, and our net is floating around in there. And then for the next 3 or 4 hours, we would give up on the seining, because what we had suspected was in there was in there. And I remember one day we'd go way back in the swamps, and we would hop from hillock to hillock, you see, and it up to your neck, and then you'd hop again, till finally we're way off, nothing but cattails surrounding you for about like 9 miles, as far as you can see, cattails and this swampy water. It's all swampy water. Cattails and big trees hanging over it once in a while, and this was right by the edge of the Indiana dunes, the lake, you know. It was all sandy, swampy, and there'd be turtles and owls and things. And I remember one day, the great confrontation I had one day was, there was a place that we used to swim once in a while in the swamp, a pool. It was just a pool in the swamp that was clear, and it had trees over it, and you could swim there. So one day, I'm creeping through the swamp. It's a devil of a place to get to, because you had to go through the swamp. Well, we were going through the swamp, me and Bruner, and we made it around the hillock and climbed up and down, and down there, right in the middle of our pool, standing there on one leg, was this ghostly thing looking at us, just looking right at us, looking me right in the eye. And I looked him in the eye, and Bruner looked him in the eye, and he looked us in the eye, and he just stood there for a minute and looked at us. It was one of the saddest looking, scary things ever. It just stood there, gray, outlined against the black water and against the black trees, just looking at us. And Bruner looked at me, and I looked at Bruner. What is it? And he looked at us, and all of a sudden he just started to go, bloop, bloop. His wings are gone. He goes, ah, ah. He makes about 3 little sad awps, and he goes, bloop, bloop, bloop. And he hops over the tree and into the next pool. And it was the first time and the only time that I've ever come face to face with a mud hen. I have seen mud hens from a distance, but this is the first time I ever came really close to a mud hen. But there was a moment of recognition. That mud hen looked at us, and we were just nothing rotten kids who were going to swim in a swamp. And I mean, this is obviously not a Westchester kid. And he was just a nothing rotten, scrawny, flea-bitten, gray, old, cruddy, red-billed mud hen standing there up to his knuckles in mud. And he looked at, you know, it was like on equal terms. He looked at us right in the eye. It was not a matter of him being afraid or us being afraid. Just looked at us. The mud hens were looking at the kids, and the kids were looking at the mud hens. Bloop, 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 away he goes. Do you want to hear a great elephant story? As long as it's summer. Well, let's get the commercials out of the way here. We have one thing. We've got the Mandarin House. And believe me, if you're coming into New York and you are going to make the New York scene over the weekend, and this is the time to come into town, I would most respectfully like to recommend a magnificent restaurant to you. This is Mandarin House, down on 13th Street between 6th and 7th in the heart of the Village. It is one of the best restaurants in New York, and certainly one of the finest Mandarin restaurants in the world. This is Mandarin food. It is different from Mandarin East. This is more Shanghai. There is some Shanghai stuff on the menu, but it is more of a, well, it's, let's say less highly colored Mandarin food. It's a very interesting kind of food. If you've never had Mandarin Oriental food, I would suggest that they have a good bar, and they're open on the weekend. It's a great place to go for a Sunday dinner. 13th Street between 6th and 7th in the village, and their garden is now open, which is wild. Okay? Now, let's see. We also have in the village the Paper Book Gallery, and they're on 6th Avenue, and they're one of the old sponsors, and they're the thing that from which this whole paper book craze started. You know, years ago they began it, and they're generally credited in the industry with starting the idea of a paper book bookstore. This is the Paper Book Gallery on 6th Avenue, just off of 8th Street, next to the Howard Johnson in the village, and they're having a gigantic clearance sale. Over 10,000 paper book volumes are now on sale at 25% off. These are all standard catalog paper book volumes, over 10,000 of them. So I would suggest you get down. And they're open till 1. Boy, let me tell you, Saturday night is the time to go to the Paper Book Gallery, about 1 o'clock in the morning. Wow. This is the Paper Book Gallery on 6th Avenue, just off of 8th Street in the village. Okay? Fine. We have an opera. What's the opera for tomorrow? Let's see. What is it, anyway? I brought it in here. Oh, here it is. Yeah. What is the opera tomorrow? Eugene Onegin. That's Tchaikovsky. That's not a very good opera. To be honest with you. I'm sorry. Of course, that's my taste, which is a pretty bad taste. I like Sheik of Araby, so you can put that where you can figure that one out. Well, do you want to hear an elephant story now? Okay, I have an elephant story. And it's from an English newspaper, and the English, more than the Americans, the English have a special relationship with things that are wild. They really do. If you follow English newspapers much, you know that their attitude towards nature and their attitude towards things that are alive and that are wild is very different from ours. And it has a lot of odd dichotomies in it, too. On one hand, the English can be, by our standards, extremely cruel towards living creatures. Oh, yes. And on the other hand, they have a strange kind of understanding that's almost Japanese-like, almost haiku-like in its attitude towards living creatures. So they're kind of a split right down the middle. And this is an English characteristic. I remember one time in Wales, I was absolutely completely thrown by the attitude of the Welsh people towards animals. They'll literally beat an animal to death if it's not doing what it should do, a donkey or a horse or something. And I've seen it happen. And yet, on the other hand, their feeling for animals and one thing or another, in a certain way, is very, very different. One thing that they do that we don't do, they treat animals as if they are animals. Americans treat animals as if they're people that haven't started to shave yet. Which, yeah, most Americans, they talk about their dog or their cat with much more tenderness and with more human concern, as though it's a human thing, than they will about their Uncle Fred. Oh, it's a very, very interesting phenomenon in America. Now, they do not look upon an animal in England, or in most countries of the world for that matter, as anything other than an animal. And so, in many ways, their relationship with an animal is healthier than ours. They will find, because they do not use the animal to replace a human being. They do not replace people with cats. They do not replace, they just don't do that. Now their attitude then, of course, is different. Now they will have a certain respect for animals as animals that we don't have. Respect is not quite the same as the kind of sentimental Valentine love that we have for animals. Now here's an example of it. This is from an English newspaper, and it's an account of an elephant. And it's an account in the way the English would write about such an event. And it happened outside of England, but it nevertheless is a report by an English reporter regarding an event that had to do with the animal world.
Whoa.
Oh. I mean, can't you taste it? This is not Westport. This is not a cookout in action now. Very good. Very good. Very good. The Elephant King is dead. The natives of Ceylon called him Old Charger. He was a magnificent elephant, completely without fear. Old Charger ruled a stretch of jungle through which the Trincomalee Colombo Railroad passed in Ceylon. Everyone who worked on the railway knew him. Old Charger and the train that made the run through the jungle had met many times before. Every 3 days, as the steam engine made its regular trip, the elephant would stand and come out of the jungle to stand on the tracks. The men on the train were not surprised to see him there. They knew that nothing was allowed to pass through Old Charger's territory without his approval. "He would block our train," said one trainman, "and force us to stop. Nothing could scare him. Only when he was good and ready did he let us pass. It was his land, and he wanted us to know it." For years, Old Charger ruled his stretch of track. But then one night last March, the train came through off schedule. A young engineer on his first run was at the throttle. The single headlight on the engine was not working properly. As usual, Old Charger came out of the jungle when he heard the train. He stood firm. He stood firm on the track. The train sped toward him through the night. Too late, the engineer saw the huge dark shadow. He blew his whistle frantically, but the elephant refused to budge. The train struck with tremendous force. The huge elephant was carried 150 yards before the train could stop. Old Charger lay sadly silent on the track. His days as king were ended. He was dead. Now that is an English attitude towards an animal. Very interesting story. Now, you see, because maybe it's because the English have spent so many countless generations in the outback thrashing about and you know, thrashing about with the natives and one thing and another. So in the end, you develop a completely different attitude. It's as if you know, this thing of the force of nature and the feeling that that I guess this is one of the reasons why so many people in America have a strange attitude, say, for something, towards something as basic as death. Death is a thing that very few Americans ever see, ever in their lives. They really don't see it. And the more you live in the abstract city, the more, of course, death becomes a very abstract thing. So whenever it happens to people, it's a kind of a dirty trick. You know, somebody made a mistake. He really flubbed up. You know, old Fred, you know, he always did muff it. Now look at him. He's dead. I said, well, that's his own fault. And people, yeah, and people in the city have a vague sense of superiority to other guys who have dead, who have died. Oh, yeah. They really do. You know? It proves that they are a little shiftier on their feet, you know, and their footwork is a little better than old Freddy. You know, he always was like that. The old fool, I knew would catch up with him finally. Yeah, oh yeah, they're very different. Now, a guy who lives out near a swamp never has that attitude towards death. Never. Oh no, never. Because there's one thing that the swamp is full of. It's not only full of millions of live things, it's full of equally millions of dead things. And you begin to realize after a while, when that bubbling comes up at this time of the year, that it equals out. It really does. It sort of equals out. And after you spend enough time saining among the moccasins, you begin to understand a little bit of this. And it's a little less exciting when you see it in real life. Now, I guess, now here is a kind of a thing where I'll have to illustrate what I mean about living closer to reality. Do you know anything about frogs in spring? Well, most people just think they holler out in the park there, you know, or they'll go out on vacation. Here's a reprint from the Quarterly Review of Biology, December 1962. This is actually just received June 7, 63. This is a study of the demography of frogs and toads by Frederick Turner. A study of natality, mortality, and age distributions among frog populations are reviewed. Now, that seems like a very esoteric thing to you, but you know what they're really writing about? Frog deluges. I read, the earliest references to Anuran demography are found in the 8th chapter of Exodus, where we are told that one summer, such large numbers of frogs abounded in the Nile Valley that the residents were severely inconvenienced. Whether this phenomenon was owing to divine displeasure with the Egyptian handling of the Hebrews or to exceptionally good survival of young frogs is a question beyond the scope of this study. There's something to think about for a minute. This early work was of an uncritical nature. We do not know whether the frogs were of mixed species populations or of one kind. They just said frogs. Nor do we know anything of the numbers involved except, quote, they covered the entire land of Egypt. Now, if you can imagine Charlton Heston saying that, it would sound, they covered the entire land of Egypt. That's more like the way it would be. But now, I would like to read to you about what happened in Wisconsin. In 1953, when there was the gigantic uprising of frogs in Wisconsin, in the summer of 52, actually. Listen to this. The hungry young frogs had come out of the marsh, and in 2 days had practically enveloped the entire town of Waldron. The explosions of amphibians beneath the wheels of automobiles at night sounded like continuous rifle fire. People mowing their lawns did so in a storm of flying frog legs and truncated frog bodies. There were so many frogs that they piled one up on the other, and they seemed so purposeful that a man that I know said that they had besieged his house one night in what he swore was a highly organized way. He had gone out on his front lawn to have a look around with his flashlight and had been confronted by a million shining, silent eyes. Little eyes. He started toward the backyard and found that he had been outflanked, surrounded. He swung the light around and discovered that the whole house was encircled. It was a scary thing to see, he said. But the plan of attack, if there had been a plan, didn't work out, because sometime during the night, the besiegers departed, leaving a great many of their comrades behind, trapped in the sunken boxes around the basement windows. He scooped out more than 2 bushels of frogs out of the window boxes alone with a shovel the following morning. Well, let me tell you about that. I can remember one day as a kid, just about this time of the year, I wasn't such a kid, actually. I was in my teens, playing in a high school ball game. And I'm playing in left field. And the entire outfield was covered with a thick coating of tiny frogs, roughly the size of your thumbnail. And when a ball was hit out there, the ball would go roll right through the grass. You know how a grass cutter goes? And behind the ball would be a cloud of little frogs. And I'd go running through the frogs, scoop it up. I have a handful of frogs. I have a ball. Quickly to my... I'd make the throw, and the third baseman is standing in there, and the ball would leave a trail of frogs behind it as I throw. It was like a tracer, just like that. And then I would return to my position to the sound of popping frogs. Just... as far as the eye could see, frogs, all little frogs, millions and millions and millions and millions of little frogs everywhere. Well, after you've played the outfield, knee-deep in the Anuran population, knee-deep in the frog world, you begin to understand something about life, and you understand something about spring, and you also, by the way, get so that you can feel the ground ball pretty good under very interesting conditions. I don't know whether Tony Kubek has ever fielded a ground ball off the back of a turtle. And then gone to his right, wrestled it away from a cow, and then... Oh, you'll learn.